Good afternoon, and welcome to Gestational Thrombophilia with Dr. Stanley Weintraub. My name is Yehuda Leder, and I'm on the board of the Student Medical Ethics Society here at Yeshiva University. Dr. Weintraub is the director of the Division of Breast Oncology and Chief of Hematology at Hackensack University Medical Center. He received his medical degree from New York Medical College and completed an internship and residency in internal medicine at Metropolitan Hospital Center in New York City. Gestational thrombophilia deals with the clotting disorders in pregnancy, which generally result in miscarriage. It is, in fact, the major cause of miscarriages in North America. Dr. Weintraub runs one of the largest miscarriage clinics in the country. Because of Dr. Weintraub, hundreds of women have been able to carry their term and deliver healthy babies. Dr. Weintraub will begin his session in just a minute. Please hold all questions until the end of the session. You can write down your questions on the paper provided for you in your folders. During the question and answer part of the session, I will hand you the mic if you have a question. Please speak directly into it, even though the mic will not carry sound. The mic is being used for recording an interactive DVD. At this time, please silence all cell phones and beepers. Without further ado, Dr. Weintraub.
Thanks, Judah. First of all, I want to thank Aaron and Chani for asking me to speak on a session that actually doesn't fully fit into the program, because the topic of the whole seminar is infertility in halacha. So you really should ask yourself a question: why have a talk about miscarriages? And hopefully by the end of the talk I will have answered that question to show how this totally fits into the goal today, which is people having more children. Just to define some terms, gestational means pregnancy-related. And when we use the word maternal, that means the problems related to the mother's side of the equation. And fetal, of course, implies the baby side of the equation. Thrombophilia means, it's Latin for loving to clot. We use the word thrombophilia, we use the word hypercoagulable states. These are states where people like to have what we will define as thrombosis or blood clots. So basically, thrombophilia, by our terms, is a predisposition to clot off blood vessels. And whether that's in an inherited situation or an acquired situation, at the end of the day, pregnancy, as I will show you, is in itself a hypercoagulable state. Every single woman is hypercoagulable. And from the mother's side, she can have phlebitis or lung clots, which can cause tremendous problems in a mother. And the danger then goes to the fetus because of something called placental vascular insufficiency, where, as I'll show you, the placenta does not get enough blood flow, and so the baby stops growing or the baby dies. So what is really the problem? So it's very well written up in the brochure. It's a terrible situation if couples have problems conceiving a child. But it's a double insult if then a couple conceives a child and then miscarries the baby. But what's the problem in the general population? So we're talking about pregnancy loss, which society has given the terrible word miscarriage to. Actually, what this really is a spontaneous abortion. Now, in the United States of America, there are 6.3 million pregnancies a year, and 4 million babies are born. 1.3 million pregnancies are terminated electively, what we call abortions. There are 1 million pregnancy losses a year. 1 million. Actually, thinking about it statistically, 20% of all pregnancies will result in a loss. We discount the elective abortions. So if 20% of women are having a miscarriage, 1 in 5 babies are lost. I'm sure everybody in the room knows somebody who's had a miscarriage. Unfortunately, like from my other end of the world, everybody knows somebody who's had breast cancer. The statistics are very alarming. Why do people lose babies? So a baby is conceived, and I'll show you a beautiful pictures of how babies are, what happens when the embryo develops. Why do people lose babies? Well, so the baby comes down, the fetus comes down, and it implants into the wall of the uterus. Well, there are two primary causes for, quote, pregnancy loss. One, chromosomal defects. Babies that are chromosomally not fit to survive, trisomy this, Down syndrome that. And then what I'm here to teach you, which is the clotting disorders in the mother that are manifested during pregnancy, which will thereby cause the fetal loss. Pregnancy, as I've stated, is in itself a hypercoagulable state. All women who take birth control pills, oral contraceptives, or who are pregnant have very high estrogen levels. And what happens then is high estrogen levels lower protein S. And protein S leads, if you have enough of it, you don't clot. If you have too little of it, you clot too much. And there's clearly a significant association between hereditary and acquired thrombophilias, that is, too much clotting disorders, and fetal loss. 60% of first trimester with pregnancy losses, and then 30% of the second trimester, and 3% of third trimester losses are related to chromosomal defects. So everybody says, I had a miscarriage because I had trisomy this, or Down syndrome this, or was a defective baby. The truth of the matter is, it's not true. Most pregnancy losses are not related to chromosomal defects at all. And as Judah stated, most pregnancy losses are related. Do you have a late pass? You have a late pass? Okay. It's very interesting. I've been speaking professionally for nearly 20 years. I always make jokes. I find this topic a difficult topic to make jokes, but I make jokes about breast cancer, so I might as well do it on this too. If you don't have a late pass, you have to go get me a late pass. After all, this is a university, no? I'm teasing. Oh, you win. Okay. Okay. So 60% of first trimester losses are chromosomal. That means 40% are something else. 70% are related to clotting disorders. Almost all third trimester losses are related to clotting disorders. So this is what a cytogenetic report looks like that comes to us from at our institution through our medical school. And that is, a woman loses a baby, and if they can get the placenta or the baby, you'll notice here that the karyotype is an XXY. Now, a normal baby is an XX, is a girl, an XY is a boy, and there's no way that this could have been a normal baby. So this is called a male karyotype with triploidy, and they interpret it as basically, this is the common finding in spontaneous abortions. Fine, so if they get the specimen and we have this, we know what caused that pregnancy loss. But the truth of the matter is, most pregnancy losses occur from something else. Just to bring it home so you understand that this is really an epidemic in the world, and certainly in America, 9 to 13% of women in the reproductive age group will have one pregnancy loss. That means if I have basically 10 women in this room, the chances are extremely high that one will have had a pregnancy loss. There's no question about it. 5% of women will have two or more pregnancy losses. And indeed, 2% of women will have three pregnancy losses. There are over 500,000 women a year that are losing babies spontaneously. And most of these women, according to statistics, there's, quote, no cause found. We in our world define recurrent pregnancy loss as one baby lost in the third trimester. For example, a woman has a stillbirth at 42 weeks. Two pregnancy losses in the second trimester, or three babies are lost in the first trimester. So what's the story? It's very simple. We all talk about embryonic stem cells, which is high in the literature, high in the newspapers today specifically. What is this embryonic thing? Well, certainly when a sperm fertilizes an egg, it becomes an embryo. And the embryo travels down the comes down the fallopian tube, comes into a uterus. The uterus is ripe for this embryo to implant into the wall of the uterus. And you've all learned this in biology. The embryo has to implant into the wall of the uterus because the embryo basically is like an astronaut in space. It has no oxygen source, no nutrients, and no way to get rid of waste products. And it's living eventually over time in a water balloon called the amniotic fluid sac. So basically, if you see the embryo here, this is the beginnings of the embryo. These are the three vessels of the umbilical cord going to a mush of tissue embedded in the woman's uterus. And this mush of tissue we call the placenta. The placenta we call the Rodney Dangerfield of medicine. The babies are born, the cords are cut, and never gets any credit for anything it does. Yet without the placenta, there would be absolutely no birth of babies. Babies in this huge amniotic fluid cavity, resting comfortably, umbilical cord, placenta. The key to life for 9 months. Shown exactly how it is, this is the baby, the triple vessel umbilical cord going into the placenta. This is a real fetus picture. So what happens? The fetus has no oxygen, no nutrients, no way to get rid of waste products. 9 months. Nobody ever thinks about it. How is it living? Well, it's quite simple. Oxygen goes from the mother to the baby. Nutrients from the mother to the baby. Waste products from the baby through the mother. As I do it in the office about 40 times a week, this way. Oxygen and nutrients from the mother to the baby. Waste products from the baby to the mother. All through capillaries and small little blood vessels in the placenta. But the magic is the blood of the mother and the blood of the baby can never touch. And the reason it can never touch is why? It's half the father. If the blood would touch, you would reject the baby as foreign. So it can't touch, but the baby has to survive this way. And indeed, it cannot come in contact, but this is how the baby lives in the amniotic cavity for 9 months. This is a picture of exactly what I'm saying under microscope provided to me by the pathologist at UMDNJ. Basically, you have little capillaries where the mother's air and oxygen and nutrients will go to the baby, waste products of the baby will go to the mother, all at this microscopic level, the blood can never touch. Shown in a depiction here, it's really very simple. The baby is here in a triple blood vessel, two umbilical arteries, one umbilical vein, feeding into the placenta. The mother feeds her blood into the placenta. And at that microscopic level, that's where the action occurs. And everything goes fine in 4 million pregnancies a year. In a mature placenta, basically what we're seeing is nutrient exchange, oxygen exchange, waste product exchange. Everything goes fine. Except when the blood vessels on the mother's side clot off. Now, everybody knows in the room of the horrible stories of the baby where the umbilical cord strangulates. And everybody knows that the baby dies because basically the baby strangulates its blood supply. That's from the fetal side. What we're here to teach you is when there are clots from the mother's side, babies will then undergo distress and there will be miscarriages. And that's exactly what we teach and what we treat in order to prevent miscarriages in our clinic. Now, that's a placental infarct, a real one from an autopsy done at the UMDNJ. And what you're seeing is a placenta which is clotted off from the mother's side. That's a placental infarct. Basically, it will cause a tremendous problem to the baby because of the blood supply that gets compromised. This is what it looks like under the microscope to the pathologist, a clot in the placental vessels, and again, a placental infarct. These are all real specimens. And a path report. So what happens when a mother loses a second or third trimester baby? The first thing I want to know is I want the path report on the placenta. If there's a placenta, that's what I want. And I want it read by a pathologist who reads them all the time. This is Debbie Heller's work from the medical school, who reads all the placentas from Hackensack and from most of New Jersey. And what she has read in this was one of my patients is an immature placenta with a triple blood vessel, with hemorrhage behind the placenta, infarction, which means that there was death of the placenta and multiple infarcts and clots. And she wrote in her report start looking for blood vessel disorders like thrombophilia. This is that report written over. Findings compatible with placental insufficiency. Look for something in the mother's blood vessels. Look for the mother to have an increased clotting state. There are two parts of problems that can occur to a mother, though. Not only can she hurt her baby, she can also hurt herself. Because women that are hypercoagulable will have phlebitis, which is clots in the lower extremities, lung clots, otherwise known as pulmonary emboli, and that is much higher in pregnancy than in normal women who are not hypercoagulable for the same reasons that they lose their babies. Now, what you were alluding to before, which we're going to get you through now, is it's not just that they lose babies. There's placental vascular insufficiency. The birth growth rate of the baby, there is intrauterine growth retardation. The babies do not grow to dates. There is pregnancy loss. The placenta abruptly detaches from the wall of the uterus, which is called placental abruption. Also, there is what society calls toxemia, what we call hypertensive disorders of pregnancy. We're going to answer questions at the end. Thanks. So hypertensive disorders of pregnancy are high blood pressure, proteinuria, swelling in the women, intrauterine growth retardation, all related to the fact that the blood supply to the placenta has been compromised by blood clots. Again, what are these disorders? The mother can clot, the babies can die in utero, there are miscarriages, there are stillbirths, there's abruption, eclampsia, and intrauterine growth retardation. For example, a woman will come to me and say that when she lost her baby at 16 weeks, the baby was really a 9-week baby. So I know already that there's been intrauterine growth retardation. The baby hasn't grown to dates because it didn't have enough blood supply. So again, we're listening to when people come in to tell us what happened so we can figure out if it's related to a clotting disorder or not. So the whole key of gestational thrombophilia is there placental vascular insufficiency or due to blood clots, or is the placenta getting enough blood? If there is a problem with the utero placental circulation, that baby's in trouble. There can be hypertensive disorders of pregnancy, abruption, pregnancy, stillborns, pregnancy loss, and so on. So the numbers get scary because I already told you we're losing a million babies a year, and we believe at least 500,000 of these babies are lost from clotting disorders of pregnancy. Think about it. Over 10 years, that's 5 million babies that are lost, that under appropriate treatment, 95 to 96% of them would be born. Scary. This is a beautiful baby, a beautiful placenta, beautiful chorionic villi. Everything's developing fine. Except there are clotting disorders that can affect this baby from the mother's side. Now, the way this works is it's either congenital or it's acquired. Congenital means it comes from the mother or the father, or it's acquired. And during the talk, we're going to discuss the congenital disorders, many of which you've heard about, some you haven't heard about, some you think are insignificant, which to us are very significant. And then we're going to talk about the acquired disorders, the ones that you do know about but don't fully understand why they cause clotting disorders, like what we call the antiphospholipid syndrome, and then disorders that are not hematologic at all, not at all. For example, women who have inflammation of their thyroid gland, otherwise known as Hashimoto's thyroiditis, or Graves' disease, which is extremely common in women and runs in families as an autoimmune disorder, have an overwhelming incidence. Should I ask him for a lay pass also? I won't. I'll let you go. I'll let you go because I let her go. It's okay. I got to let you go, right? Okay. So women with thyroiditis will have an overwhelming incidence of miscarriages. Why it happens, no one knows. How to treat it, that I'll tell you. People don't test for lipoprotein A. Yet at the last two ASH meetings, which is the association, Society of Hematology meetings, lipoprotein A, when it's elevated, has an enormously high incidence of miscarriages. So there are things that even hematologists don't do. Lipoprotein A in thyroiditis is all endocrine that we look for. So going back, the mother can clot. And indeed, mothers who clot in pregnancy, that's the number one cause of death in pregnancy. Women who have phlebitis and lung clots. And it occurs in a startlingly high rate in women who are what we call thrombophilic, to the point where we will put women who we know are hypercoagulable on anticoagulants, not so much to protect the baby, but to protect the mother. So at the end of the day, in women that are hypercoagulable, 70% of them will end up with clots and 16% with lung clots. I mean, at the end of the day, we could lose more mothers for no reason at all. And realizing that women who are pregnant, there is blood stasis, that is the blood pools in the legs, and hypercoagulable states or low protein S, women are a tremendous setter for clots during pregnancy on their own. And again, we look for this thrombotic risk factor, and we're supposed to look for it, especially in a woman who's had a prior clot, who's in a pregnancy or not in a pregnancy. A woman who's had a prior phlebitis in a prior pregnancy, when she gets pregnant, is at an enormous risk to recur her phlebitis and throw a lung clot. So she'll be anticoagulated. We have a number of young women that have had strokes for reasons that they couldn't figure out, and we did. They want to have a baby. We put them on blood thinners, and they then have a baby as well, and they don't stroke again. We're looking for things, and now we'll start using the words, antithrombin 3 deficiency, protein C deficiency, protein S deficiency. In a moment, I'll show you where all these fit in. So-called factor Leiden mutation, the factor 2 prothrombinase gene mutation. These are proteins that are either necessary to destroy clots that form or are necessary to, if you can't inactivate them, clots continue. 5 Leiden and 2 mutation are abnormal factors which, if you don't inactivate them, they just keep clotting. And these cause clots not only in the mother, but of course they cause miscarriages as well. Now, how often do you see this in the population? Antithrombin 3 deficiency is very rare. Protein C and S deficiency is rare. 5 Leiden is 5% of the normal population. Factor 2 mutation is in 2% of the population. Not a lot, except in our clinic where we see a skewed amount of this because we run a clotting clinic. So what we're looking for is, do you have too much of a blood clotting protein? Do you not destroy the clotting proteins that are activated? Do you have an anatomic situation which can lead to clots? The number one cause in pregnancy is stasis. Blood pools in the legs because of the weight pushing down. So we're looking for the clotting factors if they're elevated. We're looking for abnormalities in the proteins which knock these off. For example, if you're low in protein C, these factors will run rampant. We're looking for inadequate amount of plasminogen, which destroys clots. We're looking for abnormalities in plasminogen activator inhibitors as well. And then, where does it fit in? This is where 5 Leiden works and factor 2 mutation. These are abnormal factors which will not break down from this. Hence, these will run rampant and continue causing clots. Now, a lot of people don't feel, it's hard to understand this. You know, when you've done this for almost over 30 years, you do this in your sleep. When I was at Montefiore doing hematology, when we came there, Ted Spate would say to us, go up to the blackboard and write the clotting cascade. And here we were, these super giant fellows, and we went, huh? Well, the truth of the matter is almost everyone he trained became a chief of hematology all over the world like I did, and we can all do this. And now, of course, nobody can other than us because everybody's doing oncology. But the clotting cascade is a fascinating system of proenzymes activating each other all ultimately to form fibrin. Clotting is normal. If you bleed, you want to cause thrombosis in order to stop the bleeding. But if you have abnormalities like in 5-Leiden or 2-mutation or too little protein C or too little protein S and you can't control the clotting, then it becomes pathologic. Everything's okay physiologically. Nothing's okay pathologically. When people come to us, we're looking for all of these abnormalities, antithrombin 3, protein C, protein S. We're looking for the gene mutations. We're looking for factor 2 and factor 5 Leiden. And we're looking to see how it runs in their families. The family history becomes extremely important because these two run in families very strongly, and the heterozygous state counts. So you can have one gene from your mother or one gene from your father, and it will cause the same abnormalities if you have it from both mother and father. In the population causing clots, there's a lot more related to these, 5-Leiden and 2-mutation, than you would think would be associated with these congenital disorders. Now, 5-Leiden is in 5% of the population. And what happens is this protein becomes resistant to breakdown and then leads to a 7-fold increase in clots in the heterozygous pool, 100 times increase in the homozygous pool. 2-mutation, 2% of the population. But again, higher increases of clotting disorders. Homocysteine, a very, very, very misunderstood protein. Homocysteine is elevated, usually related to an abnormal MTHFR. MTHFR is a congenital abnormality which sometimes causes high homocysteine. It's called methylene tetrahydrofolate reductase. It in itself means nothing, but if the homocysteine is high, then there's a much higher incidence of strokes and phlebitis and pregnancy loss. Homocysteine being elevated is in 7% of the population, and the most important treatment for this is folic acid, believe it or not. How homocysteine causes clots is felt to be a direct vascular damage by the homocysteine itself. When homocysteine gets to the vessel and damages it, there is a blood clot that forms. I already told you a little about lipoprotein A. We see a lot of high lipoprotein A's in people who have unexplained strokes. And it certainly explains a lot of unexplained recurrent pregnancy losses as well. Most of you in the room who know about any of this will know about the thing called antiphospholipid syndrome. Now, my Rebbe, and there's really a Rebbe with this, about in 1980 to 82, and this whole thing was a guy named Jake Rand, who is the head of all of this at Montefiore. Then he went to Sinai for 20 years and ran clotting there, and he's back at Montefiore now. Jake helped define part of these abnormalities and trained me back in the early 80s. This is a catch-all for many, many, many proteins. Lupus anticoagulant, antiphosphatidylserine, beta-2-glycoprotein. And at the end of the day, these are blood tests which tell us that there may be a tendency to clot. No one has ever defined yet why these patients clot. But if a woman has an antiphospholipid antibody, 15% of them will have recurrent pregnancy losses. 10% of them will lose their babies in the second and third trimester. Many of them will have toxemia, hypertensive disorders of pregnancy. A quarter of them will have small babies. These babies will not grow to dates. Obviously, what's the cause? You all know now. There is increased clotting disorders in the placenta. The baby gets much less blood supply. And already in 97, it became clear that using aspirin, and at that time heparin, a blood thinner, would increase survival to 70%. Just remember that. Now, thyroiditis, I give credit to my patients. About 10 years ago, a woman was losing her babies, and we couldn't figure out why. Over, I guess it's more than that, about 15 years ago. And she kept telling us that there's a relationship between thyroiditis and inflammation of the thyroid and pregnancy loss. Now, I'm a hematologist, so this is an endocrine disorder. My endocrine guys didn't know much, and the literature had at that time one article. What the article said was absolutely not true, that women who had a thyroiditis and had low thyroid function would miscarry. And if you just gave them thyroid medication, they would stop miscarrying. We started looking at our own patients, and we realized that this was absolutely wrong. All of our patients losing babies with thyroiditis had normal thyroid function. And then we realized that this was running in families, and the mothers were losing babies, and the daughters were losing babies, and the sisters were losing babies. And we couldn't find any other clotting disorders. And then we realized that the presence of antibodies to thyroid is associated with fetal loss even when the thyroid function is normal. So the literature backed what we were seeing. So we started putting women with thyroiditis and miscarriages on blood thinners, as I'll show you later, and they had the same success rate as the patients with clotting disorders, and 96% of them were having babies. Indeed, thyroiditis is the most highest response to anticoagulation in pregnancy of anything that we've treated. And indeed, if you look, 2/3 of women with recurrent first trimester losses have antithyroid antibodies compared to 17% of controls. And the presence of antithyroid antibodies in a non-pregnant woman who's had miscarriages will have a significantly increased risk for another pregnancy loss in the next gestation. Clearly, thyroiditis is a huge cause of pregnancy loss. What are our numbers at Hackensack? These are my numbers. Of our last 100 patients, and we see about 10 new miscarriage women a week, coming now from all over the world. From Israel, we have a beautiful baby from Beit Shemesh in my office, Ramallah with Arab babies. We have French. We have South American. We even have Brooklyn, which is wonderful, which is true. We have wonderful women coming from every Hasidic sect. It's unbelievable what's happened in our clinic. It's like the most rewarding thing you've ever seen. What are our numbers? 22% of the women with recurrent pregnancy losses who come to us have the antiphospholipid syndrome. 7% are 5-lipid, 9% are 2-mutation. 17% only have thyroiditis as the cause of their miscarriages. Unbelievable. What's interesting, forgetting the other causes for a moment, is 17% of our patients have multiple causes. Many of the patients will have 1, 2, or 3 of these. But still 10%, I can't find the cause why they're losing babies. So then we play, as I'll tell you later, by sometimes the rules and sometimes the emotions of medicine. Again, we're worried about the mother. We don't want the mother to have a clot. Again, we're worried about the baby, and we don't want the baby to clot. Now, I already told you that women who have a history of clotting disorders or have a congenital tendency to clot, we will prophylactically treat them with blood thinners. We don't want their first episode to be a fatal pulmonary embolism and say, well, told you so. We would rather treat these women. This is controversial. Not everybody in the field does this. We believe all women, let's assume if they have a prothrombinase gene mutation or 5-Leiden, they must get baby aspirin and Lovenox throughout their pregnancy. And therefore, many women will come to us with a 2-mutation or a 5-Leiden. They will all be what we call thromboprophylax. They will all be given Lovenox, which I'll teach you in a moment, blood thinners to try to prevent the loss of the mother and or the baby, even if there's no personal history of thrombosis. We want to prevent maternal clots. We want to prevent fetal clots. This is our goal. Our goal is to have nice, normal babies. In our clinic now, we have many, many triplets on the wall, many, many twins, and we have a whole bunch of triplets and twins that are due soon as well in our clinic. What are we looking for? Clues. Preeclampsia, placental abruption, growth retardation, especially when women are losing babies before week 34. And we have to remember that a woman who has had, I'll give you an example. One of our friends recently, their daughter had a baby in Israel, and she had a severe placental abruption. So the first thing I emailed my friends in Israel were, tell the doctors in Israel to look for a cause, because the next baby is going to be a problem. It's chutzpah, no? Not really, because 60 to 80% of these women will have another placental abruption or will lose a baby. So the recurrence rate on problems is very, very, very high. Again, if you look at 110 women who have had abruptions, most of them will have clotting disorders in comparison to the control women. Who do we screen at Hackensack? Women who have had prior clots, women who've had a family history of clots, women who've lost three or more, as we've stated, first trimester losses, two second trimester losses, one third trimester loss, women who've had placental abruption, intrauterine growth retardation, or recurrent so-called toxemia of pregnancy, otherwise known as hypertensive disorders of pregnancy. This is our panel at Hackensack. Our panel is reviewed about every 6 months by other experts in the country to make sure that we're hitting every test that's out there so no one says we missed this. To show it to you, this is my real panel. This is how it's copied. Basically, they have a date. We result it. We know it. And we also know that this was last modified, January 05, when the last set of tests came through. Others have looked at other screening tests. Quote, my Rebbe, Jake Rand, is known for annexin 5. I heard him speak about this in Jerusalem many years ago. Annexin 5 is nice, but no one's really put credence to testing it just yet. But certainly he's put it on the map, and for that I always give him credit. So what do I do for a living? Well, half of the day I treat breast cancer because I am a Sloan Kettering trained oncologist. And half of the day, I help women have babies. How that happened is I did a heme fellowship at Montefiore for 2 years. I did research presented and published on protein C. I presented in Washington. I presented at Rockefeller. We were starving. We decided this wasn't going to work. So I decided to go into oncology at Sloan Kettering so I could make a living. My passion in life has always been the babies and the clotting and bleeding disorders of pregnancy. And the truth of the matter is, when I really looked at the numbers and I realized that it's over 500,000 babies a year, I said, this is horrible and this is striking and something's got to be done. And the truth of the matter is, most oncologists, hematologists don't know this, don't do it, and most of this work is done by the high-risk pregnancy doctors in the country, so-called maternal fetal medicine experts. Very few hematologists in the country do this. I do it. Jake does it. There's one other doctor in New York that does it. That's why people come to us from all over the world. And the truth of the matter is, they had asked us, and I thought this was the beautiful part of YU. I've always wanted to speak at YU, by the way. I've been to Harvard. I've been to Yale. I thought YU was really, this is it. I finally made it. At the end of the day, only YU would say, bring Torah into your speech. Show us how the Torah, only Aaron could come up with this, right? I love him. And the truth of the matter is, Medrash Tanchuma says that for every illness, there really is a treatment. You know, it all is min hashamayim, but there have to be messengers down here that have to do the treatments. If not, no one would get sick or no one would get better. So I thought it was very interesting to look at miscarriages on how the Gemara looks at miscarriages. What does the Gemara say about how to treat miscarriages? And then I'll tell you how we treat miscarriages. It's fascinating. Every woman knows this, that if they walk on cut fingernails, they're going to have miscarriages. This is based on a Gemara. If a woman drinks undiluted wine, she may have miscarriages. She's exposed to an eastern wind, or she smells a bad aroma, or she hears a barking dog, or sinas chinam. Well, if that caused miscarriages, there would be 10 million a year. At the end of the day, this is how the Gemara, with tremendous respect by being Shomrei Torah Mitzvahs, looks at miscarriages. How do Chazal say you should treat miscarriages, though? Well, this is very interesting. Gemara says, you don't want to have miscarriages? Sleep north to south. Don't sleep east to west. By the way, that's the way to have boys also. Gemara says that. Rashi says that also, and Gemara says it. And of course, it says the Kohanim watch over women, they shouldn't miscarry. The Kohen Gadol in Yom Kippur says it. And then there's this thing called the Tekuma stone. What is this Tekuma stone, this preserving stone? And then the ruby. And I'm told in Israel that women do wear rubies when they have miscarriages. So I was wondering, where does all this come from? Of course, Chazal say that a woman who is genetically predisposed to miscarry and other family members miscarry should wear the Tekuma stone. Shulchan Aruch talks about a Tekuma stone, and indeed, you're allowed to wear it on Shabbos, this Tekuma stone. Very interesting. This is what bothered me the most. Gemara Yevamos says that a woman who miscarries repeatedly and declares that that woman who miscarries three times is going to have a stillborn, husband has to divorce her. That scared me. That's terrible. So, that's the case. What do Chazal say about this? So Chazal say that there is such a thing called a Tekuma stone. It's actually a stone that's like a bell, and it's naturally that way, where there's a stone in a stone. And Chazal say that you can't break it, and if you wear it, you won't have miscarriages. Very interesting. Even Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach talks about the Tekuma stone preventing miscarriages. Rabbeinu Bachya, of course, talks about the ruby. And they say that the ruby, if you carry the blood, the red stone, has powers against miscarriages. Well, you know, we as doctors find this intriguing, but nevertheless, we still have to believe in medicine. Because after all, I already showed you that we believe that medicines have come down to help specific disease states. So we believe that we would like to stop divorce a different way. Now, I have a woman right now, and I'll tell you about this at the end, who is in her 14th pregnancy. I and her husband are having baby number one. She has lost 13 straight babies until she met me. Obviously, she could have been divorced already if you believe these Gemaras. On the other hand, she kept going doctor to doctor. And now, with the treatment we've given her, she will, please God, have a baby. So we are high believers, and anyone who comes to me knows this, in the use of blood thinners to prevent miscarriages and the complications of pregnancy that we've discussed. What are these magical blood thinners? Well, many years ago, we used a drug called heparin, which is a heparin sulfate, which is based on a human protein called heparan, was given subcutaneously under the skin. No one knew how often to give it because it's really an intravenous medicine. And it was helping some women. Fortunately, the Europeans developed a drug called enoxaparin. We call it Lovenox. And now we have Fragmin, now we have Erixtra. And these are long-acting heparins that are injected once or twice a day, which basically keep a woman blood thinned. They stop the procoagulants from forming blood clots. We also believe in baby aspirin very strongly because at low doses, it clearly prevents platelet aggregation. This is our protocol. This was written by us, by me. Basically, women are given Lovenox. When we find disorders, they're switched to heparin at week 37 so they can have a baby vaginally. Most of my women do not have C-sections, despite what you hear. And we believe women for 2 months after they have their babies, until the protein S comes up, remain on the Lovenox. I didn't make this up. I'm not that smart. This actually goes back a long time, but more recently, in May of 07, Dr. Bulow clearly published that aspirin clearly could reduce preeclampsia and premature births. Plain, simple aspirin. Brenner, who runs the Lovenox trials in Israel, and Israel is a pioneer in all of this, thank God, because they understand the importance of life and babies. Clearly, this trial where they compared Lovenox once a day to twice a day, they had an 80% success rate versus a 28% success rate. This is a really good trial because it also showed, and we know, that Lovenox is safe. It does not cross the placenta. So therefore, you can give it, and the baby doesn't get any anticoagulant effect, prevents pregnancy losses, decreases preeclampsia, and decreases placental abruption. Heparin versus aspirin, it's clearly been shown that heparin is much better than aspirin. Lovenox is much better than aspirin. And clearly, we who do this for a living believe you actually have to give both. In primary aborters, women who have no children, 94% will have babies with Lovenox, 80% with aspirin alone. Clearly, we believe in the combination of Lovenox and aspirin. Looking at Bick's work, if you look at his breakdown, it's a little different than ours. He sees 60% of his patients having antiphospholipid syndrome, but you'll also notice none of his patients have thyroiditis, because I don't think he's looking for it. Very interesting. But what's interesting about Bick is he has a 94% success rate using aspirin and Lovenox in women that are going to miscarry more than two-thirds of the time. Clearly, they have said that thrombophilia is a common cause of miscarriages, recurrent, in women who don't have chromosomal defects, and women like that should be given baby aspirin and low molecular weight heparin. Again, keep the blood flow in the placenta wide open. Cohen put out recently in 2006, which is a year ago at the American Society of Hematology, looking at these outcomes, 90% of women were having successful babies treated with blood thinners versus 58% of controls. Fetal loss secondary to thrombophilic risk occurred in the first trimester, second trimester, third trimester, and clearly we can improve the outcome with Lovenox and baby aspirin. How do we do this? Just like in breast cancer, we have surgeons, we have radiotherapists, and we all work, we hope, as a team. Here, we have high-risk pregnancy doctors called maternal-fetal medicine or obstetrics gynecologists who know what they're doing. And there are us, and we work together as a team. I don't make women pregnant. I don't deliver babies. I don't do obstetrics and gynecology. All I do is teach them the clotting and bleeding disorders of pregnancy, and that's all I do. The anticoagulant of choice, we believe, should be Lovenox or a drug like it. We have used Fragmin as well. We believe it, and we're quoting from Pabinger's work, that these drugs significantly reduce the risks of clotting disorders of pregnancy, which is meaningful in women with thrombophilia. And alternative treatment with proven efficacy is not available thus far. We believe in Lovenox because if you give a dose once a day, it lasts for 24 hours. If you use just heparin, you have to give it very frequently, three times a day, four times a day. There are some women that have lost stillborns at 42 weeks or have had losses on low doses of Lovenox. Those women we give therapeutic Lovenox, where we give them what we call a milligram per kilogram twice a day. We monitor 10A levels, and those women most of the time will have babies, even if they've lost babies on lower doses of Lovenox as well. Why don't we use Coumadin? Everybody in the room probably knows about Coumadin. Somebody knows somebody with atrial fibrillation or pacemakers. Most people after 70 go on Coumadin for different heart reasons. Coumadin's a pill. Why do we want to give shots? Shots hurt. They discolor the belly. They're harmful. They're just terrible. At the end of the day, Coumadin crosses the placenta. And Coumadin is a teratogen. You can't give it in the first trimester. It can make the baby abnormal. So we don't want babies to bleed. I will tell you off the record, the Israelis use Coumadin in the second and third trimester. No one else in the world would do it, and no one will do it in the first trimester. However, postpartum, women are allowed to take Lovenox or Coumadin after the baby is delivered because neither gets into the breast milk. So therefore, it's safe for the baby. We use either Lovenox 40 milligrams once a day, it's one dose, or twice a day therapeutically. We do not use the middle dose. The middle dose is Brenner's dose of 40 twice a day. It's an Israeli dose that has seen no role in America at all. The dose is chosen usually by me. Many times we'll talk to the MFM, that's the gynecologist, but at the end of the day, I make a decision of what I think is best for the patient. I think the most important misnomer out there is that the women on Lovenox have to have C-sections, and that is absolutely not true. Women are converted at week 36 or 37 to twice or three times a day heparin. Then anytime they break the water, the heparin's out of their system in about 2 to 3 hours. The anesthesiologist will do an epidural. They'll have their babies, and they go back on the Lovenox after they have a baby. Most of the kids that we are involved with, and there are now almost thousands, I would think, have been delivered vaginally, not through C-section. So again, individually dosed low molecular weight heparin is safe, an effective treatment and prophylaxis of thromboembolic complications during pregnancy and the postpartum period. That's a quote from Dr. Anderson from a year ago's HEME meetings. They don't get osteoporosis, which heparin can cause. There's very rare allergies to the drug. The biggest problem with the drug is it stings. It's in an alcohol base, and I used to inject it into one of our friends, and it's really not a comfortable drug to give or to take yourself. On the other hand, the reward I'll show you in a minute. I wanted for a second to talk a little about the topic today. The topic is the halachic implications of infertility. But I wanted to talk about how does infertility fit into what I do? I see a lot of women who get IUI, IVF, who have infertility. So you'll say, why are they sent to me? I really should deal with things after they're pregnant. And you're right, except we believe, and this is theoretical now, that there is an association of infertility and clotting disorders because we believe and we know the embryo has to implant into the wall of the uterus and the placenta has to start forming for the baby to get oxygen and nutrients. And we also know that there have been thromboses, there have been clots at the site where the embryo implants. Well, if there is a clot at the site where the embryo implants, the baby's going to die. The woman will get her natural period. She'll think she was never pregnant. She was pregnant, but she didn't have implantation of the embryo into the wall of the uterus. So a lot of our women, we have a protocol that I set up with the reproductive endocrinologist. They take the eggs. It's called egg procurement. They do in vitro fertilization. And before they do embryo transfer, before they give back the baby, we put the women on Lovenox. And our overwhelming number of women now with IVF have had babies who could not have babies before. And this protocol works. And this is what it's about. When the embryo comes in, if there is a clot here, the embryo cannot implant. The woman will shed the wall of the uterus, and there'll be no pregnancy. So what we've tried to teach you today is that there really is something called thrombophilia. And it's specifically seen more commonly in pregnant women. And it's very frequently associated with the loss of the baby or pregnancy-related complications, abruption, intruding growth retardation, hypertensive disorders of pregnancy. And we are strong believers that low molecular weight heparins and baby aspirin, post-conception, that is after the baby is an embryo, and for 8 weeks thereafter, will lead to about a 95% success rate in women that will not have a baby more than 28% on their own. Just some stories. A woman named Lydia, who's a nurse, 10 years of pregnancy loss. Lost a 42-week baby. I went into the room and I told her, she has lupus, she has the antiphospholipid syndrome. I told her, I promised her a baby in a year. It's a real chutzpah. So what happened was in a year she had Maximo, 2 years later she had Dulio, she tied her tubes. Two babies now, they're in my office. We have a woman named Natalie whose mother is a minister in the French government. One baby, four losses afterwards. We diagnosed 5 Leiden. She now has 2 new babies after that with anticoagulation therapy. Her sister lost 6 babies. We told the French, her sister's going to have the same 5 Leiden. Give her Fragmin or Lovenox. Her sister now has a baby. It's a famous story of the baby from Baltimore who was brought to me, and the mother wanted to know how she had this baby and why, because she had lost so many before, and said she only had the baby because she read my article, which Judah will give you, and basically said to her doctors, I want Lovenox. I'm tired of miscarriages. We diagnosed her with thyroiditis. She then, through the internet, sent other women from Passaic into the office as well. We worked up a family and found in the same family in different members, 2 mutation, high lipoprotein A, and thyroiditis. Different women were losing babies for different reasons in the same family grouping. I now have 2 women, 1 8 pregnancies, no babies, in her second husband now. She's finally going to have a baby. She has a 2 mutation. And now we have a woman, 13 pregnancies. In her 14th, she's having a Lovenox baby. I think we believe strongly in Los Amor al Dam Reyecha. Our concept is if the word gets spread, we can help people have their babies. It is true, if you save a life, you save the whole world. That, there's no question that the Mishnah is right. What people forget is if you destroy a life, you basically have killed the whole world. So what we have tried to do with our clinic is spread the word that we believe we can help one baby at a time. And the truth is, it's saving one baby at a time and let the word get spread. And this is our goal. These are not my babies. These are babies off the internet. I don't think I'm allowed to show you my babies. But if you want to see my babies, you come to the office. But if you come to my office, you're going to see this. 2 of them, and there are many more that I could make. Collages of babies and babies and babies. Triplets and twins, individual babies. All thrombophilic women, all who've had 1, 2, 3, 5, 10, 13 losses, some with a baby or 2 in the middle. At the end of the day, we can help these women just with appropriate therapy. And that's our goal, and I thank you. I just hope everybody who wants to have babies has babies. Thank you.
But unfortunately, to me, you're practicing the art of medicine based on empiric clinical or therapeutic trials, and I think that deserves to be appreciated. However, all of the entities you presented all smack of having some common underlying association. We know that pregnancy is an abnormal physiologic state because multiple organ systems have to make new accommodations, and the homeostasis is reset. For instance, there's an anatomical contribution also to clotting because of the decreased venous return from the location of the placenta on the vena cava. So there are obviously multiple organ systems which have to be reset to new set points, and why it takes 2 to 6 months after pregnancy for the body to return. Would you like to hazard or venture an idea why there is an immune dysfunction? I know you alluded to it, but you never really made that leap as to what could be the cause for that. Or do you know of anybody who's doing work in that area?
I knew you weren't finished. There is a bit of a controversy about the role of the, quote, immune system in miscarriages. There are some doctors who believe that if you give intravenous gamma globulin, you will change a woman's course and she'll be able to have babies. It's never been shown, and there's no data that proves that that works, unlike the data that I've shown you about anticoagulation. In terms of the multiple factors, absolutely right. It's also true in the 4 million women that have normal babies. and they don't lose their babies. The truth is, pregnancy is a normal thing. You're supposed to be able to get pregnant and have a baby. That's the natural way of life. When it changes, it's because something physiologically is going wrong. Indeed, 1 million pregnancies a year. Some of them chromosomal, some from clotting disorders. And we know we can change the fate of the clotting disorder patients almost always. Right. Yeah, there may be. You're right. You're absolutely right. But it's interesting because, as I said, there's a controversy about gamma globulin, never been shown. Not been donor pregnancy women, and it would be a very difficult thing to do. We do a lot of phoresis. It would not physiologically be smart to do on a pregnant woman. Yes, please.
Would you define a pregnancy that was never confirmed with a heartbeat or even a sac as a pregnancy
That's a very good question. I in my office, beat my head in the wall to try to figure out with each woman how many pregnancies she's really had. It's sometimes very difficult because we get words, which is what you're alluding to. A woman will say to me, so I'll say to her, number one, did you miss your period? Yes, that's good. Did you do an EPT? So an EPT is an early pregnancy test, which is very nice because it's supposed to be a way of knowing if the beta-HCG went up. Then I want to know if they did a blood test. So the first thing we want is a beta-HCG, which is a blood test. That's very important. A heartbeat, that's wonderful. That's a definitive pregnancy existence. That's a wonderful thing. An ultrasound is a good thing to have as well. A lot of women will be 8, 9 weeks pregnant, never have a heartbeat because they have a baby. Then there's this thing called a chemical pregnancy. This is a very complicated term. We think what's happening is, and I don't know if anybody really knows. In other words, woman misses her period, her beta-HCGs go up, but nothing's happening. So is this like maybe there is an embryo and maybe it's implanting and maybe it's clotting off? That's what I think it is. And on the other hand, they've never shown it to be a real embryo, so I don't know. So these are the words I hear all day, chemical pregnancy, blighted ovum. We hear these are non-viable pregnancies. There's no baby. At least that we know. What we like, the first thing I'll ask a woman on each pregnancy, I go through each one, is how many times have you been pregnant? Tell me about each pregnancy. How many weeks have you been pregnant? And was there a heartbeat, yes or no? That, to me, is extremely important.
Do you believe that there is a connection with trimethyl disorders and people and women who lose their pregnancies earlier than a heartbeat?
I think so. I think some. If it just keeps happening, I'm wondering whether or not there's a clot at the site where the baby implants. And that's what we're worried about.
As far as I understand, protein S is a deficiency that usually affects second and third trimesters. Is that true, or can it cause
okay.
a third trimester?
This is very interesting. It's a very good question. I'm happy you asked it, because if you noticed on the slide, there was in our 100 patients, one was a protein S deficiency. So if anybody's a hematologist in the room, you're supposed to ask, how did you know? You can't diagnose protein S deficiency in pregnancy, because as soon as a woman becomes pregnant, her protein S goes down, and it goes down commensurate with her pregnancy. So the answer to that is I went back on that case, and it was a woman we knew was protein S deficient when she was not pregnant. Protein S is a very tricky protein because I'll give you an example. Why do women with birth control? I have a 20-year-old girl that went on birth control pills, clotted off her whole heart. So she was treated at Mount Sinai. They took the clot out. Her mother brought her to me and said, why did my daughter on birth control pills throw a clot? We found 5 Leiden. So the answer is protein S in itself going down shouldn't cause blood clots usually. Something else with it will cause the clot. That's the point here. I mean, 5 Leidens are running around all over. They don't clot. Give them stasis, sit on a plane to Japan. A lot of people go to Japan. That is the number one flight for blood clots. Many of those patients will have a thrombophilic state. Same thing as pregnancy, but it manifests with a blood clot. Yeah. Avichai.
What do you think of giving these same talks to women who've had blood clots in not in pregnancy?
Absolutely, yes. And that is why when I made this talk up, I specifically wanted slides on maternal thrombosis. Absolutely, yes. A lot of women will come to me with 5 Leiden and 2 mutations found someplace else, and they want to know if they need Lovenox in their first pregnancy. Charlie Lockwood at Yale, who's a maternal fetal medicine expert, who is the chief of gynecology at Yale, who's a very bright man, tells them no, but he's not a hematologist. I, as a hematologist, tell them yes. The reason is we believe in risk-benefit. The benefit is so high. The risk is so high. If I don't do it, the benefit highly outweighs the risk. So we do it.
Does it make sense also that if a woman who has a miscarriage is found to have a mutation in a gene that they should do a family history so that other women who, even if they don't want to have babies, also should be able to take Lovenox or have a low-dose aspirin?
Number one, yes. Number two is we tell these women to take a baby aspirin when they're not pregnant because I never know when they're going to be predisposed. For example, my wife was in the room and I know about a doctor who married a woman, a psychiatrist from Sinai, married a lovely woman. And the next thing he knew, she had a massive stroke, right? And she was worked up by my Jake, my friend at Mount Sinai, and she was found to have the antiphospholipid syndrome. That's what she had. So she had a massive stroke. She never regained her speech, but everything else came back. She wanted to have babies. He put her on Lovenox, and she had her babies. So the truth is that women, you can have these clots out of pregnancy, and then it affects what happens during pregnancy. That's the point. Please. Thank you. You should know questions are the most rewarding thing to a speaker. People who don't ask questions mean no one heard a word I said. So I love questions. I've been doing speaking for 20 years. Without questions, I feel the whole audience went to sleep on me. Please.
I was wondering, you said you start them post-conception. I was wondering if, in any case, you would put them on or why you don't put them on before if you know they're planning to get pregnant.
That's a very good question. The only time I will put them on preconception is in an IVF baby. Number one, how do I know when they're going to conceive? With IVF, I know they're going to conceive. They have an embryo. They're inserting it. The timing is perfect. I can't keep women on this every month because for long periods of time, you can get osteoporosis and so on. So I just don't know what month a woman's going to conceive. And number two is I'm not sure I want people on blood thinners so much because I don't know if it really is necessary for everybody, and I don't want to over-treat the world. And maybe they'll bleed too much, and that'll cause a trouble. I'd rather use it on people where the risk, the benefit outweighs the risk. There, the risk may outweigh the benefit. Nothing that a doctor gives a patient is benign. Nothing. Not even aspirin. So if I give it to a woman and she bleeds, be terrible. The other thing, especially in the frum population, if I give them Lovenox and they bleed too many days, I could throw off their cycles. I can't do that. Sure. Please, please, thank you.
What about folic acid?
Yeah.
If you take that at high doses,
yeah.
Does it have any effect?
Okay, it's a very good question. Every pregnant woman is given folic acid. It's to prevent spinal disorders of pregnancy, which is very well known. The only hematologic reason I would give somebody folic acid at higher doses is in hyperhomocysteinemia, usually related to an abnormal methylene tetrahydrofolate reductase gene. Now, there is a controversy in my world about what the just MTHFR abnormality means. For my wife's sake, because some people have it, it pays my mortgage, because they're referred to me, it means nothing, but I end up finding something else. Folic acid is crucial in pregnancy, but again, too much of anything is no good, so we don't want to give you too much if you don't need it. It would be that would be a hyperhomocysteinemic case.
But then there was also a question of, is this a genetic thing?
Yes, so MTHFR is the gene.
Okay,
so getting back to your question about families and men. With MTHFR, yes, because men with hyperhomocysteinemia can have heart attacks. So that's number one. Number two is in terms of who do you check, men, women, is this a racist thing? I mean, a sexist thing? No. Men, the problem, most men are not going to get into a hypercoagulable state. Their number one place in hypercoagulability is flying to China or flying to Israel. That's it. They don't get pregnant. They don't take birth control pills. They don't take estrogens. They don't go into menopause. So they, at the end of the day, their biggest risk is they fly to Israel or they fly to Japan on a 10, 14-hour flight. So those people, we want them on aspirin. We want them to walk. We tell them to drink a lot of fluids. We tell them not to drink a lot of alcohol. We want them to pee a lot so they get out of their seats. We ask them to fly business and not coach, if at all possible, because of the legroom issue. Or fly JetBlue, which is a joke, gives you more legroom. It's a joke, never mind. Men, what about, well, men, number one, have daughters. So men have daughters. If men have daughters, the daughters, I worry about pregnancy and, again, the whole thing we've talked about. And again, that's really why men, I don't worry as much as I worry about women. And, yes, all family members have to be checked. I had a whole headache recently. I had these young, rich women come see me whose father I found something. He went nuts on me. I found a clotting disorder on him, and I wanted them tested. So we tested. Thank God they didn't have it. But we want the families to be tested and then to learn how to deal with it. That's the big thing.
I have a second
please.
Question. How do you know if somebody's at risk for alcohol?
Oh, so I had that on the list. There is a list of who we screen, prior miscarriages, prior clots, family histories, and so on. There is a list that we follow. Yes, please. I know back there. I got you. Don't worry. Go ahead.
Is it just the presence of the antibodies, or does it have any correlation to the level of the antibodies?
Okay, that's a very, very good question. And just to take the question further, with beta-2-glycoprotein, there's an IgG and IgM. With antiphospholipid, there's an IgG. There's an IgA and IgM. With antiphosphatidylserine, there's a G and an M. The truth of the matter is, at the end of the day, if they're positive with a history, it counts.
What about without a history?
Then it probably, we're not sure. At the most, we might tell them to take a baby aspirin. It all depends. There it depends on the specific case and the specific setting. There really is an individual approach to all of this, really.
Just another question, so which I think the answer that you just gave will probably answer this one. So if somebody's diagnosed with a thrombophilia during pregnancy and treated until 8 weeks postpartum, would you treat them, women, when they're not pregnant?
Baby aspirin. When they're not pregnant, they stay on baby aspirin.
Always.
As long as it doesn't affect the menstrual cycle, yes. So if it affects their cycle and the number of days they bleed, in this setting, it's clear that you all understand me, and I try to explain this to women all day. Then if they bleed a lot, I tell them to take a baby aspirin 3 times a week. If not, I tell them to take it every day. I personally take a whole aspirin every day, and I can't tell you why because I don't know. Because I believe it prevents colon cancer. That's the real reason, and I have no data to back that, so don't fight with me, please. Yes, please. You're so patient. Thank you.
Would you be an advocate of running your screening panel on just normal pregnant women?
No.
Just as a part of...
No, but I have to make you a confession. How many of you watch Fox News? So if you watch Fox News, you know about Dr. Manny. And Dr. Manny is my chief of gynecology, Manny Alvarez, who I love very much. And Manny does a partial thrombophilic panel on every patient who comes into his office. I don't know why. He used to be chief at Sinai. Jake Rand was there. So that's not a good thing, but he does it. It leads to a lot of unnecessary consults with me and headaches. So the answer is no, because it's going to lead to a lot of headaches. So, 5% of women are 5-lied. That means 95% aren't. 2% of factor 2 mutation. That means 98% aren't. Should I test 100 people for 7? I have in the room economists and lawyers, and you could all figure out that it is not cost effective in our society. The answer is no. It's a very good question, and I live with this problem every day, by the way.
She doesn't have so many years to get pregnant.
Yes. Oh. This is such a good question. I feel so good. I go through this every day. I look at the eyes. One of the good parts in my kids know this in the room. I took seven courses in college in psych. I love psych. I read into women's minds all day. I look at their eyes. I need to know if they can handle another miss or not. So as you know, not in our world, but in the world I live in, a lot of women are getting married older. And a lot of women are having that first child at 38 or 40, and they can't handle another miss if they have one. So we will assess that, and there are many women who've had one loss that I will give Lovenox in the next pregnancy. If we talk to them about risk-benefit, if we find anything, or baby aspirin, because I know they've only got a year or two more to have kids, I do have a heart, and that's the art of this whole thing. This whole talk is art, because this is an art we have created with our clinic and why people come to me. Look, 1 week, this is a God's honest truth. I had a couple from Beit Shemesh came to me. The next week in the same couch sat fully dressed Arabs from Ramallah. When I asked them where they're from, they said Palestine. I mean, I go through this all day long because the internet has made my clinic totally one small flat world, as Tom Friedman says, and it's just unbelievable. Yeah, so now these, finally, you know, now that there's a little more time, we're trying to spread, quote, the gospel out. This stuff works. The science is there. The art is there. The people are coming. I'll tell you my biggest problem. My biggest problem is the famous story of the woman who comes to me from Square. Now, I have a lot of Hasidim, and so I said to her, how did you get to me? Which Hasidic sect are you? Okay, so I had Samir this week. They're wonderful because people talk. People talk there. So I had this Rebbe and his wife from Square. I said, what happened? He says, we keep having miscarriages. So the Rebbe sent us to Zalman. Now, on one of the other breakouts is my very good friend, Zalman Levine, who talked about multiples and how you destroy one. Zalman is very close to me. We do a tremendous amount of work together. So Zalman tells me, he says, you don't have any problems getting pregnant. You have problems keeping pregnancy. Go to Weintraub. So they come to me, and I found something, and I put her on Lovenox. Now she's going to have a baby. So she screams at me. She says, so many women in Square are losing babies. Why they don't come to you? I said to the husband, can you go to the Rebbe? It's Lo Samad Al Dam Reyecha. I said, please. They hate when I say that, and I'm not wearing a yarmulke in the office. They go out of their minds. And this is the truth. I say to them, it's Lo Samad Al Dam Reyecha. You have to go to the Rebbe and say, I don't need the work, but come to me. Husband says, for sure, we'll go to the Rebbe. So she gets pregnant, she comes back to me. I said to him, did you go to the Rebbe? He says, no, can't get to the Rebbe. Rebbe's too busy. I say, wait a second. I may be a misnagi, but let me tell you something. My father was a Radom Sukhasid. You can get to any Rebbe you want. Go to his guys. Go to the conciliaries. I have no time. So the truth is, I know why they didn't go, because Meshem Tzuch, people don't want to talk. That she's pregnant, she's happy, she's going to have her babies. The truth of the matter is, people don't want to spread this gospel. And that's why if you watch, and I don't mean disrespect, I hope it's not taping, but at the end of the day, a lot of the organizations related to infertility don't want to talk about miscarriages. You talk about speaking, right? They bring in all the speakers on infertility, but nobody wants to talk about miscarriages. Right? You do who? So tell us. Oh, so a time I love very much, as you probably know. This article, giving them Hakara Satov, the article you're going to give is given out, was published in a Time. And a lot of my babies are because of that article that women read who brought to their doctors, like the woman in Baltimore, and said, I want this medicine. So the truth of the matter is the Time is very, very on the... And they send me a lot of work when women go to them. So you have to go. So that's the story. I really thank you very much. Your questions were very gratifying. Thank you.